Welcome to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. The global migrant crisis exceeds all others. There are 60 million people displaced. In fact, one out of every 120 people in the world is displaced. In the first half hour, we'll hear my in-studio conversation with Deputy Secretary of State Tony Blinken. We discussed what governments, including the U.S., can do. In the second half hour, I'll be in conversation with Nancy Lindberg. She's president of the U.S. Institute for Peace, and she'll provide her own perspective. And now to my conversation with Deputy Secretary Blinken. I'm here with the Deputy Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, who's traveled out to Silicon Valley to talk to tech leaders here, as well as philanthropists and others, about the migrant crisis, the refugee crisis around the world. So I thought you'd just start, Mr. Secretary, by saying a word about the scope of the problem, the magnitude of the problem.
Well, you know, it's easy to talk about a crisis or something of historic proportions. We tend to throw around those words a lot, but this really is something of historic proportions. We've got a global refugee crisis, and there's a lot of focus on Syria, and I know we'll come to that, but it is global in scale. Mm-hmm. And if you put all of the refugees in the world together into one country, it would be the 24th largest country in the world, bigger than Spain, bigger than South Korea. Right now, one out of every 120 people is displaced through violence, conflict, strife. Mm-hmm. And what this is doing is it's actually remaking the world that we're living in. It is challenging economies. It's challenging security and borders. It's challenging labor markets. It's challenging political orders. And in a profound way, it's actually challenging our values. Are we able to live up to our own values in addressing this crisis?
You referred to political orders, then we'll move on to your other points. There does seem to be some sort of an unraveling of states in the region. Mm. We've got Syria, we've got Libya. We always worry about the status of things in Iraq, trying to shore up things in Afghanistan. How hopeful are you about basically the Levant, that region, that swath of the world that seems to be so fragile right now?
Well, it's a huge challenge because what we're seeing is the calling into question and the change in political orders that have existed for decades or even longer. And that process takes a long time to play out. And as it plays out, it tends to create vacuums. And those vacuums tend to be filled by the most extreme voices and the most extreme actors. And so it creates, unfortunately, a terrain in which groups like ISIL, like Daesh, can find sanctuary and find places from which to operate. And this, of course, poses a security challenge for us in the United States and partners around the world. The challenge not only of failing states that we're grappling with, but really a changing order. And by the way, this is not confined to the Middle East. What we see around the world is power changing and shifting among countries, within countries, and indeed beyond and below them, as non-state actors emerge, empowered by technology, empowered by connectivity, as other countries challenge the existing order that we helped to forge after World War II, all of these things are coming together. And in some cases, this increased technology, connectivity, and even interdependence is a good thing. And it's creating new ways of working together, new incentives to collaborate. But it's also creating a lot of shared vulnerabilities as the order in different places unravels. But it's probably no more acute than it is in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. As you think about that technology, I know that you aren't here to talk about the problem of ISIS or Daesh with Silicon Valley leaders, but I know there have been previous conversations about the role that some of these tech companies can play, particularly those in the field of social media, can play in breaking the brand of ISIS. Do you have thoughts about that?
Well, two things. First, the broader reason that we're out here now for these couple of days, we focused intensely on the refugee crisis and particularly education for refugees, and maybe we'll come to that. But more broadly, we've launched an initiative at the State Department that we're calling an innovation forum. And the idea is this. We know that virtually all of the issues we're grappling with on a day-in, day-out basis back in Washington in terms of our foreign policy and our national security policy are at the nexus of foreign policy and technology. When we're looking at how to strengthen arms control agreements, how to prevent the proliferation of weapons, how to think about creating rules of the road in cyberspace or in outer space, that's right at the intersection of policy and technology. But also, a lot of the big things that we're trying to do around the world, whether it's build global health security, mm-hmm. food security, energy security, whether it's ending extreme poverty or educating refugees, there are answers from the innovation community, the technological community, that are profoundly relevant and that we need to integrate. But here's the problem. There's not a lot of natural connectivity between Washington and the innovation communities in our country. Not a lot of bridges that exist. And that's exactly what we've created with this innovation forum. We're bringing people together on a regular basis, innovators, technologists, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, who can help us see around the innovation corner. And at the same time, we will give them a sharper picture of what we're trying to do. And many of the things we're trying to do with our foreign policy is something that people will be excited about because it is for not only the national good, but also we think for the common good. And if we can bring that together in a more consistent and coordinated way, I think we can be a lot more effective around the world. So that's the bigger project we're working on here. But specifically, we've been focused these couple of days on how to help refugees get to school.
So let's get to that. Let me start, though. We'll focus in on Syria. Mm. But start with those displaced within, because there are about 4 million Syrians, perhaps more. They're displaced within. Some of them are in towns that are under siege, with no ability to get food or medicines to them. Has that been a problem that's been solved yet, or are they still not reachable by aid agencies?
So there are actually now about 6.5 million Syrians who are internally displaced. And of those, almost 50% are children. And of course, that poses the unique challenges, especially when kids are out of schools. So the answer is, this is something that we and the rest of the international community have been working very hard on. And in some places, we've actually made real progress in terms of getting resources into communities, helping local governments deliver services, including education. But it varies dramatically across the map of Syria. It depends entirely on where we, other countries, international organizations have access. Where we do have access, we've made a real difference with significant resources going in and demonstrable progress on the ground, helping people work through their lives in a better way. But the real problem remains in many parts of the country, simply an inability of anyone to get access because the situation in those parts of the country is too dangerous and difficult.
And so the lucky ones get out, in essence, and make it to the frontline states, to Turkey, to Jordan, to Lebanon. What do they find there? We imagine them all in refugee camps. Is that the case?
It's not. But here's what happens, Jane. First, what's driving people out of Syria, three things that are interrelated. Violence being number one. But the violence has knock-on consequences. It means that if you're in a town or a city that is in the middle of the conflict, chances are all of your infrastructure is getting knocked out too. Businesses are being bombed and shelled. You lose your job. So that's another driver, the lack of employment. And at the same time, chances are the school's been destroyed or taken over, or teachers have been killed or forced to flee. And so there's no place for children to go to school. That's the other driver. Violence, education, employment. When people make it out of Syria, and typically they go to three places, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, the good news is the violence driver is gone. But what sometimes remains is the driver of a lack of access to education and a lack of access to jobs. These countries have been extraordinarily generous with their resources in trying to accommodate refugees. Think about this. Lebanon, somewhere between 1/4 and 1/3 of the population of the entire country is now a Syrian refugee. There are more Syrians in public schools in Lebanon than there are Lebanese. And you ask yourself, if we were faced with that situation, what would we do? Turkey, extraordinary numbers there, and Jordan as well, relative to the size of the population. But despite that generosity, there is, in all three countries, when it comes to education, a lack of capacity, not enough classrooms, not enough schoolhouses, not enough teachers. Those are already under strain with the existing indigenous population. Add the refugees to it, and it becomes an almost unbearable burden and a simple lack of capacity. And then if you want to work, it's awful hard for a political leader to tell his or her people, you know, we're going to give some jobs to the Syrian refugees even though you don't have jobs. Mm-hmm. So, and these two things, education, employment, are profoundly intertwined. Because what happens is if the parents can't work, can't get a work permit, or there's no job, then they tend to push their children into the informal economy. It's easier for kids to find those kinds of jobs that at least put a bare minimum of bread on the table, but then they're not in school. Final point, to address your question, we have this image that most people are actually in refugee camps, but in fact, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands are not. They are in host communities. That is, they come into Turkey or Lebanon or Jordan, and instead of going to a refugee camp, they try and establish themselves in a town, in a village, in a city. And on one level, that sounds good because we have an image of refugee camps in our minds that's not necessarily a positive one. But a refugee camp, especially if it's a good one and it's being well run, puts a roof over your head. It puts food on the table. It puts clothes on your back. If you're not in a camp, if you've tried to integrate a host community, you're coming over with some savings. Those savings get depleted. You're not able to work, or you can't find a job. And then what do? How do you put food on the table? How do you put clothes on your kids' back? How do you send people to school? That's the dilemma that we're faced with in many of these countries.
Yep. You said in your meeting with several of the Tuck entrepreneurs, you said the consequences of these things tend to fall on the smallest shoulders, yeah, on the children. Say something about the risks for girls and boys who are out of school in that setting.
First and foremost, the risk is that we have an entire generation of children who don't have the skills and knowledge that comes with school to be productive members of society, whatever that society happens to be. We have the risk that this lost generation, when the civil war in Syria is finally over, will not be able to rebuild their own country because they won't have the skills and knowledge to do it. But worse even than that is that in the absence of school, children are much more susceptible to things like forced labor, early marriage, human trafficking, prostitution, and even extremism. Mm-hmm. And then you have a vicious cycle that goes on and on and on and condemns communities and countries to failure for generations. It has to be interrupted. So first and foremost, it's a moral issue and a humanitarian issue, but it's actually a national security issue for the countries in question, but also for us, because we can see through a lost generation, a new generation of extremism coming to the rise, taking advantage of that vacuum, finding new recruits who are in despair and have nothing to look for. So we have an obligation that's both grounded, I think, in morality, but also grounded in practicality, mm-hmm, and the necessity from a security perspective of not allowing a lost generation to grow up.
A situation where our values and our interests come together.
Absolutely.
Closely aligned. I want to turn to some pragmatic solutions, mm-hmm, but before I do, it sounds like what you're saying is that the real reason migrants will then go on, mm-hmm, will make that treacherous, incredibly dangerous trip to Europe, mm-hmm, is because they lack jobs, is because they lack opportunity.
That's exactly
for education.
Right.
What do they find when they get to Europe? There's such an uneven response.
Well, and Europe continues to grapple with coming up with a uniform response. And it's a debate that is shaking the foundations of the European Union and the entire construction project that has been so beneficial to citizens of Europe, but also to the entire world, that's taken place both since the end of World War II and then since the end of the Cold War. It's calling into question virtually all of the political arrangements and economic arrangements that have been made. So the stakes are huge. But you see a great diversity in responses. Of course, Germany has been exceptionally open and generous despite the extraordinary numbers of refugees who are going there. But it poses a real political challenge for the leadership. And we see different responses in different countries. The Europeans continue to work on seeing if they can develop a more uniform response that, that shares the burden. Mm-hmm. But the other challenge is that, and again, emphasizing that this is a global problem, the second largest group of refugees coming to Europe is coming from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So that in and of itself poses its own unique set of challenges.
No, the numbers are pretty overwhelming. So that question of integration really, really comes to the fore. We've taken very few in the U.S., and I know that President Obama has wanted to increase those numbers. But 31 governors said, not in my state. And some candidates for the presidency say, no more Syrians. Do you see us doing more?
Yes. First, we've just experienced an extraordinary pendulum swing in public sentiment on this and political sentiment on this. Remember that just a few months ago, we had a photograph that traveled around the world of a young Syrian child who'd washed up dead on the shores in Turkey and was being carried in the arms of a Turkish soldier. And the response to that was incredibly powerful, and it was basically to the government, open the doors, bring everyone in, we have to do more. And our response was, yes, but we have a security imperative as well, and we have to make sure that folks we're bringing in won't pose a threat to our security, and we have a very, very vigorous process in place. So that was the nature of the argument then. Just weeks later, the horrific attacks in Paris happened, and then San Bernardino. And the pendulum swung all the way to the other side, and it was shut the door, keep everyone out. And we explained again that, in fact, we have an extraordinarily robust system for making sure that those we bring in and resettle don't pose a security threat. Here's the challenge. First, most people who leave, let's say Syria, their hope is to go back. And as soon as the conflict is over, that's what they want to do. And so they want to stay close at hand. So their preference is to stay in the neighboring states to facilitate going home, as a general rule. But as we discussed, if they can't get their kids to school, if they can't find jobs, that creates a pressure for onward migration, and then they head, despite the incredibly treacherous journey, traffickers, et cetera, to Europe and other places. But a very small percentage of people in the aggregate actually wind up being resettled in third countries. And the way the process works is the United Nations is responsible in the first instance for looking at this pool of people and evaluating them and making referrals to different countries for those who want to be resettled. And that winds up being a very, very, very small percentage of the number of refugees or displaced persons who are even susceptible to being resettled. So we're looking at a very small number of people to begin with that are referred to us by the United Nations. Once that happens, we're focused on bringing in women, children, the sick, and those who are most immediately at risk of violence and conflict. A very small number of people that we bring in as refugees from Syria are unattached single males who don't have a family. It's about less than 2%. So, and the process overall, from the time you apply to the time you get in, takes between 18 and 24 months.
Yeah.
So, all of that said, the president believes that we need to do more. We've raised the ceiling that was in place, and we are looking at taking at least 10,000 Syrian refugees next year. But in order to do that, we also need to put in place more people to screen and vet those who are candidates for resettlement. That means hiring them. It means training them. It means deploying them, getting them out there. None of that happens automatically. All of it takes time. It's a real process. we're working through it.
Yep. So let's turn to some of the solutions. Today, a lot of the folks in the room were interested in looking at the issue of how to provide online education that could be blended with in-school or at-home education. Was there anything that are you working for with organizations like Coursera and Udacity and Khan Academy and others that are doing this?
Yeah, there is extraordinary creativity in trying to answer the problem. So right now, if you look at the three countries of first refuge or first asylum, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, in Lebanon, we have about 300,000 children who are not in a formal education program. In Jordan, it's about 35,000. And in Turkey, it's about 400,000. Those are the rough numbers. And what we're looking at doing is figuring out how to answer the problem, and it starts with mapping the problem. What are the impediments to actually getting kids in school? So, when it comes to formal education, first, one of the impediments across all three countries is simply a lack of classrooms and schools and the infrastructure that mm-hmm. you need. We've been engaged over the last several years in significant projects to help build more schools, more classrooms in these countries. Other countries have been doing the same thing. So we're building up the infrastructure. The problem is that takes time.
Yep. Have you met with companies like Autodesk and others that do this kind of design? And,
yes, yeah. We've been engaged with countries working directly with them bilaterally.
Yep.
We've also been engaged with agencies in the international community, the UN agencies that are working on this. Mm. But the process of doing that takes time. Second, you have to have teachers. And you already have systems that are overburdened, and teachers are already a little bit overwhelmed. But in a number of these countries, they're actually taking on second shifts and teaching Syrian refugees in the afternoon, having taught local students during the morning or even into the evening. But you've got to be able to bring more teachers in. You've got to be able to pay for them. And sometimes you have to train them to deal with the particular circumstances that Syrian refugees find themselves in and the trauma that some of them have endured. You have to deal with things like, and this is really striking, it's not something that you would immediately think of, but when you go and talk to refugee families and ask them what some of the barriers are to getting their kids in school, one of the things that comes back again and again in the countries that I visited is transportation. Many of them live too far from the school. There's no transportation to get them there. Or if there is, they can't afford it mm-hmm. because they are almost literally without money. So we're looking at how we can build up transportation networks that can help get kids to school. Fees, books, uniforms, all of that. So all of that takes time. We're making progress. We're working on it, but it takes time. So one of the things that you do to fill the gap is so-called informal or non-formal education. And there, community centers, NGOs can help keep kids up to speed on the basics, the fundamentals, language, math, you name it. But there the challenge often is bringing the programs in and finding ways to deliver them, getting local governments to accredit them to make sure that if someone is getting an informal education, that will actually count when they're able to get back into the formal education system. And that's where the U.S. government comes in, working with other governments to get them focused on accreditation mm-hmm. and making sure that it counts. But one of the big answers that we're finding is exactly what the technological community can help bring to bear. Things like distance learning, virtual classrooms. Syrians are extraordinarily well-educated. They tend to be computer literate. If you can get a tablet into someone's hands, if you can get a curriculum that's approved and agreed and uniform on that tablet, if you can then connect a teacher at least occasionally to those students, you can actually keep people in the education system, keep them moving forward, and get them to the point where when there are opportunities in the formal system, when a chair in a classroom opens up, that they are ready to do that and prepared to do that. So we're driving all of this. But there's some interesting, unique challenges. Turkey, not an Arabic-speaking country. Syrians, Arabic-speaking. So even if you have all the goodwill in the world with the classrooms and the teachers, it may be hard to communicate. We're looking and even deploying some extraordinary translation technology that allows for real-time instruction with the translation. But we also need the Turks, for example, to help accredit Syrian refugee teachers who were there and who are not able to educate their own kids.
So let's turn to the problem of jobs or livelihoods. My understanding is that in both Lebanon and Jordan, it is not legal for a refugee to take a job in the economy. And in Turkey, it's just starting to issue work permits, I believe, but with help from us, I think, in order to be able to absorb this into their economy. Say something about that challenge and how we can be of help. I know of one proposal, for example, for special economic zones. I don't know whether that's a feasible one, but talk about what the solutions might be.
So we've got to solve both problems, as we said, at the same time, because they're so intertwined. Because, again, if parents are not able to work, then the tendency is to push children into the informal economy, and then they're out of school. So, and, of course, if you're not in a refugee camp, if you're fending for yourself, if you have to pay for your housing, if you have to pay for your food, if you have to pay for your clothing, you've got to have an income. So at the same time, it's usually challenging to tell a politician, to tell a leader that they have to dedicate jobs to refugees when there are not enough jobs to go around for their own people. So we need to find creative solutions there. And you're right. A big challenge is getting work permits. And, of course, even where there are work permits, you've got to match them with jobs. But there are creative ways of approaching this problem that are politically sustainable as well as economically viable. Certain categories of refugees may be more easily employable without displacing local workers, the teachers, for example, who have a unique skill set, humanitarian aid workers who happen to be from the refugee population, people who are willing to do jobs that the local population doesn't want to do. We see this, of course, in every country with the migrant population taking the jobs at the low end of the scale because those already established don't want them. And all of those kinds of jobs exist in all three countries. But the even more creative solutions are exactly one of the things you alluded to, something like a special economic zone. Can you establish a particular area where both Syrian refugees and local workers collaborate together to make something, and that product in turn, when it's exported, enjoys a special status in the country that's bringing it in with no taxes or tariffs to make that particularly attractive? That can be part of the answer, and indeed there are very concrete proposals that are moving forward now. But the bottom line is, on all of this, is that any of the solutions you find have to be sustainable for the host community as well as for the refugees. And we have to look at ways to make lemonade out of this lemon. So one of the things that we're grappling with is that for decades, we've had a wall in our own thinking and our own approach to these problems between in our government and in the international system, between those who are doing immediate humanitarian emergency response, let's get clothes on someone's back, let's put food on the table, let's get them emergency medical assistance, and those who are thinking about development and building something sustainable. We have to take down those barriers in the way we approach this problem so that when we're thinking about how to help refugees, we're also helping the local community. And that's the only way it's going to make it politically sustainable. So if you're investing in infrastructure, in schools, for example, those schools should benefit locals as well as refugees, and then there'll be support. Similarly, if your company is investing, that can be a very good thing for the local population. But you can dedicate a certain number of jobs to refugees in the new business venture, and still say to the local population, well, this venture wouldn't be here if it weren't for that, but we're giving you jobs as well. So there can be win-wins that we have to find, especially if we put this through a development lens as well as a humanitarian response lens.
So at the same time that you're working along these tracks, I mean, the job of a deputy secretary is truly multitasking. Mm-hmm. At the same time that you're working along these tracks, you're also working on the Syrian, on putting together the peace talks. And there, you know, what's needed at the table are some pretty strange bedfellows, you know, from us to the Saudis, to the Iranians, to the Russians, mm-hmm. to the rebels, to the Assad government. Have they agreed to come to the table?
So, most recently, in the last hour or two, yes, but it's a real challenge. We have a Secretary of State, John Kerry, who is working 48 hours a day on trying to make this happen. And we made, with his leadership, extraordinary progress before the new year, bringing together around the same table the most critical actors who don't often sit at the same table together: Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, the United States, Turkey, and virtually all of the neighboring countries, as well as European partners. And there was agreement that came out of those meetings in Vienna that resulted in a resolution at the United Nations Security Council that sets a clear pathway forward toward toward change, political change in Syria. There was agreement that there should be a political transition in Syria. And that's important because that's the first time that all of these countries have agreed just on the need for a political transition. Mm-hmm. There was agreement that negotiations toward that should begin in January. There was agreement that that should lead within 6 months to a more representative governance in Syria. And there was agreement that in 18 months there should be elections in Syria. And finally, agreement that we should all work toward a ceasefire. So there's a path forward. The hard part now is actually implementing that. And part of the challenge is making sure that the opposition groups come together, have a common agenda, speak with one voice, and come to the table, just as the Assad regime needs to be brought to the table and to engage in a serious and constructive manner, unlike in the past when they came to the table and did nothing and didn't engage. There is, despite all of the challenges in doing this, I think still a real opportunity. The UN is in the lead in convening these talks, bringing them together, starting them. It's going to be a very challenging, very laborious process. But at the end of the day, many of the main actors in this drama really do have an incentive to try to end the conflict and resolve it. And it's also imperative because not only is there the horrific moral, humanitarian dimension of the conflict and all of the victims of that conflict in Syria, failure to address that also creates the space for Daesh. And indeed, as long as Assad is in power, he remains a magnet for Daesh, for ISIL, and the biggest propaganda recruiting tool that they have. So we have a double incentive. We want to end the conflict. We want to stop the killing. But we also want to take away the space that Daesh has to operate and the recruiting tool that it has in the Assad regime, and that doesn't happen until you actually get this political transition. So very, very difficult, but we are intensely focused on it.
So the U.S. has said that an outcome that involved keeping Assad in place was unacceptable. Mm. What about Assad's government? By that I mean the technocrats, the civil servants, the managers of the current government.
We've been very clear that one of the things that should happen is that the basic institutions of the state remain intact. One of the mistakes that we made in Iraq, in the war in Iraq, was actually disbanding and dismantling several of the key institutions of the state, including the Iraqi military. We don't want to repeat that in Syria. So when it comes to those who are populating and working in government agencies, the vast majority of those people would be able to stay in any resolution. Technocrats, bureaucrats, government workers, government officials, the expectation is that many would stay. The institutions would remain stood up. But the senior leadership that's been responsible for perpetrating horrific violence on its own people, that's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. There will not be stability. There will not be peace as long as Mr. Assad and the people immediately around him who have been responsible for leading Syria into the civil war, as long as they're still there. Mm-hmm. But the institutions and most of the people who run them should remain.
Now, Mr. Secretary, you're coming back. You've said to the various groups you met with today that you're eager to come back and keep engaging in a very proactive way with Silicon Valley. But by that, what I mean is people from the tech sectors, many of whom are philanthropists themselves, but also just plain problem solvers. I noticed that you, in fact, announced a challenge grant today. If you just say a word about that, and then we'll close off with your sort of long-term view of this relationship with private actors.
Well, this is an ongoing process and an ongoing engagement, an ongoing relationship. What we don't want to do is have one-off conversations where we say a lot of good, interesting-sounding things and then nothing happens. We need to keep the pressure on ourselves to actually deliver. As one young woman said at the end of the workshop that we just had, mm-hmm. we've got to keep it real and actually focus on delivering concrete results and progress for real people leading real lives on the ground. So what I want to do is come back and see whether the very good ideas that emerged today on figuring out how to deliver more education for refugees are actually turning into something real. Part of that, though, goes to challenging the community to develop, for example, and this is part of the challenge that we announced today, to develop apps for education that in a very practical way can help children have access to learning materials and to move forward. And we're doing this in collaboration with the Norwegian government, the Australians, and others. And hopefully putting that challenge on the table will stimulate a lot of creative thinking. Mm.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation, but also thank you for the reaching out that you're doing to the private sector. There are a lot of Americans and others who really want to help and make a difference, but the opportunity to coordinate and collaborate is what they seek. So,
Jane, well, thank you. And this is one of our greatest sources of strength. Wherever I travel around the world on behalf of the United States, meeting with my counterparts in governments, but also meeting with people from all walks of life. We may be in a place where they profoundly oppose a policy we're pursuing, dislike something we're doing, or object to this or object to that. But one of the constants, almost every place in the world that you go, is a profound admiration and attraction to American innovation, to American education, to American entrepreneurship. These are among our greatest strengths. And if government can work more effectively with these communities, it will only amplify that strength and make us more effective in what we're trying to do around the world for the good of our own people and, I think, for the good of people everywhere.
Thank you very much, Tony Blinken.
Thanks.
You're listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. We just heard from my conversation with Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and we'll now turn to my conversation with Nancy Lindberg. She's president of the U.S. Institute for Peace. She recently served at USAID, and prior to that led Mercy Corps, one of the world's leading humanitarian organizations. This conversation was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Nancy Lindberg heads up the U.S. Institute of Peace, which is a Washington-based think tank / action-oriented organization that's really focused on the prevention of violent conflict, the resolution of violent conflict, and post-conflict reconstruction. So she has an enormously important mission and agenda, and it's an organization that's known for really getting things done. So please join me in welcoming Nancy Lindberg. Nancy, as we look at, you are recently back from Iraq and Afghanistan, so we're going to get to that. But just as we look at the region of the MENA region, North Africa, the Gulf, the Middle East, even, you know, spanning to Iraq, it feels like constant crisis. It feels like a series of very fragile states almost unraveling. Is this a unique moment in history? Is this a more complicated moment in history for someone like you who is working so hard to rebuild societies, strengthen societies, and deal with fragility like this?
That's exactly the right question. And it's a little bit of both really good news and news that means we need to focus even more on those regions. And of course, what's really galvanizing a lot of attention is the movement of so many people into Europe right now. This is an historic time in terms of the number of people who are globally displaced by conflict. 60 million people have been displaced by conflict, which is the highest number globally since World War II. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole new situation in terms of people on the move. Some are refugees, some are economic migrants, but they're coming from exactly, as you said, this arc of fragility that encompasses the Middle East and a number of countries in Africa. Although for the first time, the number of displaced people has shifted from being primarily the bigger numbers in Africa to bigger numbers in the Middle East, mm-hmm. which is a shift. But it's also coming at a time where you have a global humanitarian system that is stretched to the limits with not enough resources. You have four of what are called level three emergencies. And these are designated highest mobilization required emergencies. Mm-hmm. It's like four alarm fires that says, international community, we need to mobilize to ensure that we can really address the severity. And the four include South Sudan, Central Africa Republic, Iraq, and Syria. So it really is both the Middle East and key African countries. Mm-hmm. And to me, it underscores both that we need to rethink somehow we manage, organize, and deliver our humanitarian assistance, and also that even as we wrestle with refugees and the whole issue of resettlement, that we absolutely need to keep our focus on the region from mm-hmm. which all these people are coming and that arc of fragility.
So let's talk about Syria for a little bit and the effect, and as you referenced, you've got a lot of Syrians coming into Europe, and that's what's captured the attention of the Western media. But of course, they're the frontline states. There's Lebanon, there's mm-hmm. Jordan, there's Turkey that have been absorbing, well, perhaps not absorbing, but have had extraordinary numbers of Syrians arrive in great concentration. Talk a little bit about the degree to which their infrastructure is stretched, their systems are stretched by this pressure.
Well, and that's exactly what's happening. They are stretched. They have absorbed the bulk of the 4 million Syrian refugees who have left their country since the conflict began. We're now in the fifth year of the Syrian conflict. And the region was already saturated with refugees from Iraq, from Palestine. And you have now in Lebanon, already a fragile, politically tumultuous country, 1 in 4 Lebanese are now a Syrian refugee. 25% of their population is a Syrian refugee. This is unimaginable mm-hmm. To consider that level of influx to the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's in a region that has epic water shortages. Jordan is one of the most water insecure countries in the world. So the water systems, the sewer, schools, clinics, all of this infrastructure was not built for that level of usage. I was in northern Iraq in the Kurdish areas where 1 in 5 is a displaced Iraqi, all the Iraqis who fled ISIS as they came into Iraq. And they have, because of the drop in the oil prices, they only have 40% of their budget. So not only is all of their infrastructure stressed, but they are having significant budgetary issues, and they are fighting a war because the Peshmerga are very... So all of this means that at a time where global humanitarian giving is nowhere near meeting the needs, the appeal for the Syrian crisis is only about 40% filled. It's about half of the money being asked for the humanitarian response in Iraq. That means that these host communities, many of which are already poor and vulnerable, are very stretched. And mm-hmm. so you have a combustible mixture. Now, I will say we've all been saying that for several years, and remarkably, these communities keep managing and keep hanging on. But the question is, can they continue to
do
so?
Right. Now, of course, the United Nations has a very large role to play, but UNHCR has been underfunded. There have been a recent set of pledges made. What does the funding situation look like?
Well, it's still quite underfunded. One thing I would say is that there's also, against going back to those other crises, you know, in any other year, what's going on in Iraq in and of itself would be an extraordinary humanitarian situation, and South Sudan and Central Africa and, of course, Syria. And we have them all. Mm-hmm. So it's the funding across that all of the emergencies. And then you've got Yemen, yes. Somalia, DRC. Yes. I mean, it's a long list right now. There needs to be a broader base of countries that provide assistance. It's a very small number of countries, Western Europe, Japan, United States, and the United States has been the largest donor to the Syrian crisis by far. It's, I think, $4.5 billion since the crisis began. Yeah.
So we've been providing financial assistance and have pledged more, but we haven't taken in many refugees ourselves. In fact, I heard a member of Congress quoted as saying, please, we have our own immigrant problem. Immigration problem is what he meant. Do we have our own immigration problem? And is that even remotely relevant? And should we be accepting more?
You know, we have had a global cap of refugees, meaning any refugees coming from anywhere, of about 70,000 per year. There was a recent decision to increase that global cap to 85,000. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of activity and advocacy right now to say, please accept 100,000 Syrian refugees. Consider that against the number of refugees that the surrounding region has taken in, mm-hmm. where between Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, it's more than 3 million refugees. Mm-hmm. The missing piece in all of this is how vital the refugee intake through the years has been for the United States. I mean, we are a country of immigrants and refugees, and there has been extraordinary economic vitality injected into countries that are aging out. Mm-hmm. And this is an issue in Europe as well. So it's a tricky conversation. It's difficult, but we can take so many more than we are taking right now. Yeah. And we also should continue to keep our focus on the source of the problems, the countries that are so fragile, so weak, so repressive.
Yeah, yeah. Given how much you know, both as a former government official and as leader of Mercy Corps and now leading USIP, you know, as you think about a diplomatic process in Iraq and in Syria, let's just start with Syria. If the Russians could be brought to the table, the U.S. could be brought to the table, what would be the long-term objective, in your view?
Well, I think the immediate objective is to stop the violence, stop the absolute, you know, reckless pummeling of the Syrian people, which is, I mean, it's gut-wrenching what's going on there. Mm-hmm. So stopping the violence and creating the space for a process to emerge in which the Syrian people have an opportunity to create their own future. There's a lot of conversation about can Syria be put back together or not. I think that will be a longer term question, and it's ultimately up for the Syrians to make that determination. But you can't even begin that dialogue in the case of so much death and displacement and ongoing violence.
Can you imagine a circumstance in which Assad would stay in a transitional role, or am I just thinking way too far out given the circumstances of today?
You know, I think it would ultimately depend on whether there is acceptance by some of the Syrian opposition groups. Mm-hmm. It goes again to this, what we were talking about in terms of transitional justice and how key perpetrators of terrible violence and crimes, how are they able to still be in a position of authority and power with mm-hmm. legitimacy? And I think the assumption is, in the case of Assad, no, there's no way that he could, because there's just no legitimacy there. He's systematically killed his people for certainly over the last 4.5 years, mm-hmm. one could argue even before then.
Mm-hmm. So we have question cards that ask about, in fact, we talked a little bit about dignity in the context of the appeal of Daesh or ISIL. This questioner asks how refugees, particularly the Syrians, how can they maintain dignity in a situation like this as they go into Europe? You know, there are Greek citizens out there rescuing the drowning, but at the same time, you've got the Hungarian government putting up a fence. You've got a lot of tens of thousands of people basically in a no man's land, not welcome. What is the effect on their psyche? How can they maintain some level of dignity? And how will it make it think about their own role as either Europeans or if they're back home?
That is a really important question, because it goes to the heart of how we respond to people who are displaced and people who are refugees. When I was in northern Iraq, I was talking to a civil society activist who said, you know, we have 7 refugee camps in Erbil, a city in northern Iraq. So that means we have 7 time bombs. Hmm. Why? Because most of the children are not in school. Many of the people are dealing with deep, deep trauma. Most of them can't find work. And one of the realities of host countries is that many of them have official policies that prohibit people from working as a refugee. Mm-hmm. And so deprived of work often means you are utterly deprived of dignity. And that there's a clear correlation to a rise of domestic violence that occurs among refugee populations. Often the only way they can make a living is their kids. If there is school, they have to pull them out. One of the issues that I'm really struck by is there are, I think the figure is in the neighborhood of 12 million children in the Middle East who are displaced and out of school. And the likelihood of refugee children actually getting to school is very low. It's somewhere in the 50% range. This is huge. Mm-hmm. This is huge that you have so many children in that region, out of school, feeling hopeless, no future to fasten to. This is a cauldron. This is a recruiting opportunity of great mm-hmm. potential. Mm-hmm. And so I think at our peril, don't look more closely at the kind of assistance that really focuses on how to help kids get back into school, how to help people make a living, how to provide assistance that is fundamentally about enabling people to maintain their dignity. And one final thing, because I'm really taken about this, the research on what is the impact on children under 5 on their brain development mm-hmm. when they are in toxic environments with stress, with conflict, with social exclusion. And it's almost as potent as the deprivation from malnutrition yep. and micronutrients. So you have a generation growing up now in that part of the world. And, you know, you want to talk to the leaders and say, do you know that you're depriving your country of a future? Mm-hmm. Not to mention, you know, the 50 years of development gains that Syria has lost, but the future gains yeah. that it is mortgaging.
Yeah. And I actually will want to turn to how your experience in government helped inform you, or how the priorities that you walked into government with helped inform this process. But let me just say, when we think about the education of kids, and we think about within refugee camps, right? We're thinking about the children being able to go to school within the refugee camps and about others who've been somehow denied that kind of basic education. But what about sort of a reminder that university students had their studies interrupted, and these are the folks who would be managers, would be entrepreneurs, would be government officials
yep. right,
in a Syria without war. How does one absorb them into universities in Europe and here? And how does one help build that capacity, maintain that capacity to go back and rebuild a society like that?
You're absolutely right, because in fact, I met a young woman who had been actually sitting for her university exams, her mm-hmm. entrance exams, when Daesh swept through her neighborhood in Mosul in Iraq. She and her family fled. This was almost a year and a half ago. And since then, she's in an apartment with 3 families. Mm-hmm. Their savings are being depleted. She hasn't been back to school since then. And she's just looking at her future evaporating. And there's just no clear sense of what the next steps are. And, you know, it's in that backdrop that I think about, you know, what would you do? Would you try to get to Europe? You know, would you take that dangerous journey, or would you stay and with hopes that your country will turn around? I think we need to look at bold solutions and mm-hmm. ways in which one can help that generation, you know, anybody under 25, mm-hmm. recapture some sense of hope and dreams for a future life. And it's not just going to be taking them to other countries, mm-hmm. because a lot of people don't want to leave. I talked with a number of Christians many of whom are displaced in northern Iraq. And they're saying, if we go to Europe, we lose our identity. These are communities that have been in place since biblical times. And it fundamentally changes Iraq and the mosaic that has been there for millennia. Mm-hmm. To your point of how do people think about their future?
Mm-hmm. The next questioner asks about reconstruction in the context, it's sort of asking about division of labor. So this questioner asks whether this is reconstruction after violent conflict, after war, and what is the role for the military in that? And the questioner notes that often a big piece is left to the military, meaning our military, not the local, and what is the role for others? I raise this in part, both because we have this great question, but also because I know that throughout your career, you have thought about three different strands: the strand of defense, the role of the military, the strand of diplomacy, the role of that we associate with the State Department, the strand of development, which you've devoted your career to. So talk a bit about the division of labor when it comes to reconstruction.
I think when we work within the international system, we can leverage our contributions far more effectively. And sometimes the World Bank is in the best position to really take the lead on reconstruction. It clearly depends on the situation. Where the military is essential is on helping to provide security as well as helping to train security forces. Because essential in any post-conflict environment is people having a sense of security, that they can go home, they won't be killed, they can be in their homes with a future. I mean, just think about going home after you've been pushed out. You maybe fear your neighbors. For you to have confidence that you can resettle and reinvest, you've got to be secure. That's where the military can be really critical. And then there needs to be, I think, a very important aspect put on reconciliation so that some of that social fabric can be rebuilt, especially when communities have been scattered and violent crimes have been committed. There is a very important role for the military, and I will also say that we are so imbalanced in what we fund as a country. If you think about a $500 billion defense budget, $500 billion, and it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $47 billion for all of our diplomacy and development. All the ways that we engage the world through our civilian capacities is $47 billion versus $500 billion. I would say we need to learn how to wage peace as well as we wage war. And we need to fund in a way that enables us to do that. And the rebuilding and the reconstruction and all of that has to fundamentally be based on enabling that reconciliation to occur and the peace to happen, or you'll just go back down into conflict again. And I know from 20 years of working in conflict zones that over and over again, schools are built, clinics are built, roads are built, and then one bomb wipes it all out again.
Right. So, Nancy Limburger, I want to thank you and ask you all to join me in thanking her for the work she does.
Thank you, Jane.
You've been listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this episode were my recent conversations with Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken and President of the U.S. Institute of Peace, Nancy Limburg. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode, to register for an upcoming event, or to support the World Affairs Council. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Robert Zimmerman. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.